Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, bringing you 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We're live now and you can catch it later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, delivering all the essential updates you need, fast and focused. It's Thursday, the 22nd of August. Coming up on the program, the big Qatar Airways Airlink deal, the legacy of TV maths teacher William Smith. Can the EFF and MK work alongside each other, and the benefits of a family office approach when it comes to investing? Qatar Airways has acquired a 25% stake in the South African regional carrier Airlink, all part of its ambitions to expand operations further across Africa. The investment in Airlink, which flies between 15 African countries, if I'm not mistaken, will improve a code-sharing partnership between the two carriers. I'm in conversation now with Airlink's Chief Executive Officer, Roger Foster. Roger, welcome to you. This partnership then with Qatar, how is it aligning with your long-term growth strategy?
Hi, Jeremy, and thanks very much indeed for having me on your program. Firstly, we're very excited to have Qatar on board. You know, this is the world's best airline by multiple measures at the moment, highly revered, highly accredited, an organization of integrity that had vision, that had the capability of implementing its vision, the determination to do so, and I mean, now it's really the best airline in the world. So in terms of having a partner, a strategic equity partner, we're absolutely thrilled that Qatar has seen fit to take up this 25% stake in Airlink. And how does it enhance our ability to realize our own aspirations for Africa? Well, I think that that's got to be a conservative step-by-step approach. You know, we're delighted to have a 25% equity stakeholder in the business, such as Qatar. But at the same time, we have to carry on plodding our own way through the implementation of our strategy. As it is at the moment, you've mentioned that we operate 15 countries in the sub-region. We're operating 85,000 flights per annum at the moment. And this gives us the propensity, the ability from a balance sheet perspective to be able to continue upping our game, improving on that, expanding our network into destinations that we don't currently operate within our portfolio, but at the same time, densifying everything that we do, so we call it an organic development into the various routes that we currently offer services on.
As far as Airlink is concerned, is the balance inevitably going to move more northwards towards Africa and other destinations rather than local?
Well, we see our domain as sub-regional for now, so Southern Africa, SADC, and you know we're already starting to venture into a little bit of East Africa with services to Nairobi and Dar es Salaam and the like. But the tie-up with Qatar will probably give us a larger presence in Central Africa. I think it's well known that they already have a relationship with Rwanda in Rwanda, Kigali. And, you know, not to say that that's definitely part of what's on our radar screen in the short term. We have the traffic rights to Kigali. We have the traffic rights to Kinshasa. We have the traffic rights to Brazzaville, to Libreville, to Ghana, Accra as well. So this will probably, on a step-by-step approach, allow us to expand the network into these destinations. But we don't have ambitions at this point in time of becoming pan-African. I mean, that's not part of something which is realizable, and I'm not saying it's not possible, but I think, you know, a step-by-step approach. Let's focus on what we're doing, be the best version of ourselves that we possibly can be, make sure that whatever we do in the region is to the best of our ability, and that goes about enhancing the frequencies of service to key destinations throughout our network and making sure that we are providing connectivity, especially to Qatar, but not limited to Qatar. You know, we've got 35 other commercial airline relationships, and the aim here is as we bolster Airlink and improve our position in the sub-region, we also want to enhance the connectivity that we already enjoy with those 35 airline partners.
You will concede, though, Roger, that the phrase Pan-African Airline does have a nice ring to it, though.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves, Jeremy. It does. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day, and I think that what we've seen in the way of Airlink's performance, you know, pursuant to what happened with COVID and the structural change of the domestic and sub-regional aviation industry, where we saw so many airline failures, I think we've been able to capitalize on our position and bear in mind that, you know, the acquisition of a portfolio of destinations within a network is not something where you click your fingers and you've got that in place overnight. This takes years and years of strategic visioning and then the implementation over time. So what we have in the way of a very, very powerful network, you know, operating over 50 destinations, more than 60 routes without the sub-region, within the sub-region rather, you know, that's taken almost a lifetime to aggregate. So a Pan-African vision, as I say, you know, you can dream it and you can think it, you can implement it, but, you know, step by step. I think Airlink has been built on responsible premises over the history book. We've never got ahead of ourselves to the point where we can trip over our own feet. And that's what we intend continuing doing, you know, build it, but build it responsibly, viably, and in a sustainable way so that whatever we put in place becomes a legacy going into the future.
So, Roger Foster, let's do the money dance now. I will ask you the question, what's the deal worth? You will very eloquently segue to something else, and I'll come back with a follow-up question saying, how long did the deal take to put together?
Well, let's start with that one because that's the easy one. The other one is impossible. So, it's, you know, transactions of this nature don't happen overnight. And I can say that, you know, the negotiations started in earnest probably 2 years ago. And the due diligence started around about a year ago and was concluded about 6 months ago. So there was about a 6 month process of due diligence. And then subsequently, we've been working on documentation. And bear in mind that, you know, these are all, technically speaking, negotiations and conversations, and nothing is irrevocable until all of your conditions precedent have been concluded and the documentation has been signed. So we have signed the documentation. There are one or two CPs that are outstanding at the moment, but the process has taken about 2 years to get from where we began to where we are at the moment. And then in terms of the number part of it, you know, it's something that, you know, Airlink being a private company and given the fact that this is Qatar Airways, which is an organ of the state of Qatar, it's not something that we can divulge. But it is a material number from an Airlink perspective, especially recognizing the trauma that the whole industry has been confronted by, and Airlink has been able to navigate its way through those difficulties and position itself as it has done. As a comprehensive airline system throughout the sub-region, so much so that it has been alluring to the likes of Qatar to invest in our business.
Roger, what sort of edge do you think this gives you over Safair, which also is not only an arch rival, but also has regional aspiration?
I think that we see the airline business models as being different, but as being converging. If we look at our airline business model, we are premised on the network and on connectivity and on having reach into all the corners of the earth through the airline partnerships, through our relationship with IATA, the clearinghouses, the settlement plan systems, and so on. And in order to get into that position, you have to be in the global distribution system. And you have to be in a inventory hosting system, inventory being the seats on every flight multiplied in Airlink's case by 85,000 a year in advance, because that's the range of the system. You can sell tickets a year in advance. And you have to be able to deliver that inventory into the global domain. Now, where we have airline partnerships, and those partnerships operate in the global domain, and you take a partner the likes of Qatar, It has a reach into markets which become the source markets for Airlink destinations within our sub-region, and they do so better than practically most others are able to do that. Now, in the case of FlySafair, traditionally their model has been what we refer to as a point-to-point model. They haven't relied so much on connectivity to the extent that we have, and they sell to, you know, the traveling public that needs to go from Johannesburg to Cape Town or from Cape Town to Johannesburg, and not to destinations beyond either of those two. Whereas everything that we do is about picking up a customer in a source market like Cape Town and then flying them either on our own system or on the systems of our partner airlines to another destination, be it within the sub-region or be it anywhere else in the world. Now, yes, they aspire to operate in the region, and does SAFAIR aspire to operate in a point-to-point model in the region, or does it aspire to becoming a connecting airline like we are, a connecting service provider, what we call a network airline service provider? So we'll wait and see. What this does is it gives us some power in terms of our relationship with Qatar, which has already been very strong and well-established. It's a reliable relationship. We've got the other relationships, as I say, but let's just focus on the Qatar relationship. It gives us access to the Qatar network in a comprehensive way, and it enables us to sit with Qatar and figure out strategically key points in the sub-region that need to make connection with their services, which we will then endeavor to do to make sure that our flights connect with theirs and that theirs connect with ours. But they also connect the dots of our network to the dots of their network in a comprehensive way to create a matrix system of destinations served both by our network through our hubs, Johannesburg and Cape Town, as well as their hub, which is Doha, and how Doha connects all the other points of their network to those points within ours and theirs in Africa.
And I am going to leave it there, Roger Foster. Out of time, I'm afraid, but thank you very much indeed for the explanation. That's the Chief Executive Officer of Airlink, Roger Foster.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let me pivot now from aviation to politics. It's been a week, if memory serves, since Floyd Shivambu resigned as the deputy president of the Economic Freedom Fighters. The development now raising real questions about the impact that decision on political parties outside of the GNU and the relationship between the EFF and the MK party that is briefing on the issue today. Political commentator Sandile Swana is with me. Sandile, welcome to you. As far as MK is concerned, a lot of internal chaos over the past 2 weeks or so. What's your sense here? Is this a long-term party or a one-hit wonder?
Thank you, Jeremy. I think that they've got to really settle their institutional arrangements, make sure that there's a constitution, that they enforce a published code of conduct, proper elections and proper structures. And hopefully Floyd Shivambu, in coming in there, will be able to contribute to that. And the chaotic nature and history of Jacob Zuma needs to be neutralized on the most urgent basis inside the party itself.
How does he contribute? What exactly would his remit be, do you think?
Sorry, are you talking about Zuma or Floyd?
I'm talking about Floyd Shivambu. So he walks into a party which has got a degree of chaos. Where does he start building?
Yeah, so the first thing is institutional arrangements. You know, in one of the clips that was circulated long before this, before the firing of the other members of parliament, there was a clip where Dr. John Schlope was complaining about the lack of discipline even amongst the members of parliament who are not punctual, who are not fulfilling their duties in parliament. So Floyd has got to introduce discipline, punctuality, adherence to the constitution, adherence to guidelines, to build a proper and disciplined organization. That is where he has got to start, even before he launches into very big political manifestos and things like that.
Is he going to be given the space to do that, or is Jacob Zuma going to run interference?
If we look at the history of Jacob Zuma in the ANC, where Jacob Zuma could fire ministers in the middle of the night, where DGs, I mean, the greatest vacancies of DDGs and DGs was during Zuma's time. It was just chaos. So that is going to be a big risk, including getting Floyd fired himself.
What do you think the prospects are then for this so-called progressive caucus now that MK and EFF, I would suggest, you are in direct competition for the same voter base?
I think that Malema has made a correct call by wanting to remain separate and distinct from the MK party for the very reasons that you and I are discussing now. If you look at, you know, I was reading a message by Douglas Gibson of the DA, and he was saying, look, it took us as the DA more than 60 years to be where we are today. So Malema doesn't need to panic in building his party and be opportunistic and grab anything that comes along. Because certainly those who grabbed onto Zuma, even in the 2000 and 2007 era, today regret it. So I don't think Malema should move closer. He should maintain his ideological position and maintain his party separate and distinct from the ANC, which is another chaotic entity, and also from Jacob Zuma and his MK party.
As far as Jacob Zuma is concerned and his advancing age, it would be fair to say, surely, that Chivambu would not have made the move unless he would see himself as a future leader of the party.
That presents an opportunity, but, you know, when you see Jacob Zuma in public, I may be mistaken, he appears stronger than Biden of the United States. So 5 years with Jacob Zuma can be too long, I'm telling you. So Floyd has made a calculation that maybe, and Jacob Zuma is a sweet talker, Jacob Zuma could have promised him heaven and earth, but the greatest risk to MK party is Jacob Zuma himself.
And finally, do you think the GNU should be worried about these developments?
For as long as Jacob Zuma is there, I think by and large, and interfering with the running of the party, as we see, is very fluid. They are safe. He's helping the GNU to make the left ineffective and undignified and all those types of things. So I don't think for now it is there. It is when Floyd, actually, a person like Floyd or people of that sort start being proper leaders of that party, that then the GNU has got serious competition from MK party.
Always appreciate your time. That's political writer and commentator Sandile Swana.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Many of us listening today will have had mathematics and science teacher William Smith to thank for our results, and now at the age of 85 has died after a brief battle with cancer. Dr. Johannes Ferreira, senior lecturer at the Department of Statistics at the University of Pretoria, joins me now. And first of all, Dr. Ferreira, how did Smith's innovative teaching methods change or revolutionize the way in which maths and science was taught?
I think one of the overarching pillars of importance that William Smith contributed, first and foremost, was to inspire confidence. Confidence when you think about science in general, and then specifically towards secondary education, primary education even, that if you are scared of maths, equations, which, you know, relates through to physics and chemistry as well, to inspire that sense of confidence that you can do it, and with a very, very gentle approach that allows the individuals to think and be able to, yeah, let me use the word confidence again, in order to address, think about problems at hand, even if it was just in a very formal secondary or primary assessment context. I think that's the first thing for me that comes to mind about the importance of his contribution.
And that's such an important point that you raise, because it also says a lot about the way in which maths and science is taught these days. There is a genuine fear of these so-called STEM subjects.
Absolutely. I think the challenge is that with so much in the world going around, often so many numbers being reported, often so many different ways how people think about things, the systematic approach in the STEM subjects about how to think systematically, how to break down a problem, how to reach a solution, is not necessarily mathematics or physics or chemistry exclusive. Even though we feel some of the concepts might seem a little bit abstract, it's the approach that one uses to solve any kind of problems in your life. So I think it's important to view it in that way. Mm. And the gentle, nurturing type of approach that William Smith employed is essential and is often still missing in many aspects of our broad spectrum education curriculum.
It was about confidence, it was about empathy, but it was also this astonishing ability to simplify complex subjects.
Yes, there's so many things that are usually considered complex or abstract. It's like looking at a cake, but then you realize there's actually 2-3 eggs, there's a cup of flour, there's a bit of baking soda. What exactly are the smaller ingredients? And actually, can I use the description, reverse engineering the thought process to not only view the cake off the bat, but actually understanding the ingredients. And once one has a hold on the ingredients and understanding the process and time necessary to result in the end product, in this metaphor, a cake, I think is incredibly important. And he was a stalwart in allowing that train of thought to happen.
That is such a good metaphor because at the very heart of it, he helped you find the eggs at the very beginning, which is often something that we're unable to do, or certainly in my case, I was unable to do.
Exactly. I spoke to my mother about this as well yesterday. My mother was my science teacher in high school, and she reflected remembering seeing some of his contributions and being inspired by some of it, even in the late 80s and then throughout the 90s. And the gentle approach that is often missing, and understandably so in some contexts, that teachers and students are pushed into large classes. We have this overwhelming need and urge for education. And it can be overwhelming on both sides, students and educators alike. And as a brief reminder that, you know, we are all still human, and the compassion and the diligence that's needed in that regard in order to facilitate learning is sometimes that is something that goes a little bit off the rails. And that's something that I think is essential to reflect on, to incorporate in whatever educational context whoever of us are still involved in.
Then, of course, there was the learning channel, and that had a profound impact on disadvantaged students. And it also reflected his bigger vision for accessible education.
Yes, I think I recall reading the SABC initially. They were a little bit hesitant about foreseeing the success of something like that. And then once that took off, the lasting impact is just astounding. Of course, these days, we live in quite a different era, considering that we have access to internet platforms such as YouTube, some content creators, you know, sharing concepts and discussions on Instagram, places like that. It really was William Smith was one of South Africa's, dare I say, initial and most impactful science content creators, even though it was shared on a broadcasting platform such as the SABC and elsewhere in Africa.
That's a very, very good observation. What steps do you think can be taken then to ensure that this big legacy continues and will inspire and influence, one hopes, future generations of educators?
I think the important thing is to realize now more than ever before that learning is a lot more interdisciplinary, and especially with the change in generation, the change in the type of students and learners that we have in front of us as educators. I think the idea of interdisciplinarity makes us realize that people learn in different ways, whether it is via teaching via short stories, via how indigenous knowledge, for example, has been relayed over the decades, over the centuries. How people consume content has become drastically different. And this also, of course, reflects in how we should think about creating material, be it textbooks, videos, remedial education, in-person education, and how one can think about how that has to be addressed people learn now drastically different than they did before. And that is one thing that I think educators need to reflect on. Not only reflect, but discuss amongst each other, discuss amongst educators of different generations of how to really effectively address that and implement it in a feasible and meaningful way.
Thank you so much for a very meaningful and thoughtful tribute, Dr. Johannes Ferreira, Senior Lecturer, Department of Statistics at the University of Pretoria.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, in this Women's Month, when it comes to wealth and investing, understanding what women want is simple. Sound financial advice that secures their financial well-being today and into the future. But, says my next guest, there are unique considerations for women compared to men when it comes to building wealth. My guest is Nicola Langridge, a certified financial planner at Private Client Holdings. And first of all, Nicola, how do these income disparities and career interruptions that women face, I guess, more than men, impact the ability to build wealth over time?
So mostly, even though things have improved in South Africa, if we look at statistics, women are still earning on average 30% less than men. And in the corporate world, even with big changes being made, 28% less than men. So we have less to save. And unfortunately, or fortunately, women still live also on average 7 years longer than their partner, which means they have a longer time period in retirement to put money away for, which equates to about 25% more savings over your lifetime that you're putting away. So you're trying to save 25% more, but your income is 30% less. So it is something that we do need to take into account with female clients.
So is there a specific strategy then that women can employ to overcome this financial confidence gap and maybe feel a little bit more empowered and successful in managing the finances? Or do you think that disparity is always going to exist?
Look, we hope that that disparity goes less and less over time as things change. And it has improved so much over time already that you'd hope that it continues. But I think starting early for a woman, educating our daughters and granddaughters to start early, to not wait to start saving, even a little bit every month from your first paycheck helps a lot. And compounding that over time makes sure that it does grow. Then also seeing an advisor from an early age. So an advisor will set those goals for you that you need and assist with choosing the right structures. Because women are pretty good investors in general. I mean, there's a lot of articles from Forbes 2023 and a little bit earlier before that that states women are better investors because they are slightly more risk averse, because they tend to stick to a plan for longer, not make many changes. So as long as you start early and you have those goals and you have someone helping you make the right decisions, I think it is possible to overcome that gap.
I accept that to a point, but I would also suggest to you, Nicola, that often an understanding or an embracing of risk can have positive impacts when it comes to investment.
Yes, definitely. So when we look at a profile, being risk averse means not just in the sense that I was meaning now, is not making too many changes. But it's definitely necessary to take a healthy amount of risk on your profile. It is something that women need a little bit more encouragement. I mean, looking just at putting something in a money market might get you an 8% return, but after tax, you're going to have less than inflation returns over a long time. So we tend to look at a bucket type strategy, you know, anything that you need for the next 3 to 5 years, putting it in less risky investments, but anything over the time frame of 5 and up years, you definitely need to look at holding at least 75% equity in those portfolios to make sure that it grows efficiently over time. And it's there just understanding which vehicles, because I mean, there's risky equities and there's less risky equities. So just helping your client to understand what strategies would work for them over time and making them feel comfortable with the plan, it already goes a long way.
You are also a proponent of the family office approach to wealth management in addressing the unique financial needs of women, such as you've just outlined to me.
Yeah, so the family office approach basically means that we look at more than just your portfolio, just more than just your investments. So we have a very strong fiduciary team that will make sure that succession planning is properly looked at, that your will is correctly structured, that some form of an estate plan is done. An example I like to use quite often is we had a woman that had saved quite a bit, and she'd left this huge offshore share portfolio to charities because she'd saved up quite a bit offshore, but quite a substantial local portfolio and her primary residence to her family in South Africa. But unfortunately, what she didn't understand, because she hadn't seen an advisor before, you know, before the estate got wound up, before she passed away, was that your estate duty in South Africa is calculated on your worldwide assets, but it's paid out of your South African estate. So even though her intention was that these offshore charities got some funds and the, you know, that her local family as well looked after, the funds in the local portfolio was used for the estate duty due to the, you know, extensive offshore portfolio. So her in leaving her family here with very little, and that was not her intention at all. So if she had had the will looked at by a fiduciary specialist, this problem would not have happened. So it's just bringing in the fiduciary aspect, making sure any trusts or companies in the families are correctly structured and looked after, making sure that any long-term insurance needs are looked after. You might have way too much life cover, but not enough dread disease. Having the tax side of thing, we have a big tax practice as well. Making sure that the investment plan that you put in place is tax efficient is equally important. So the family office approach means that we have a range of specialists in different areas that make sure that your holistic plan is properly looked after and not just the investments, because, you know, tax and estate planning can have such a major effect on your portfolio.
I want to rewind to that phrase you've used about the importance of succession planning and, I guess, legacy building. Why is that so important?
I mean, we all want to make sure that what we've created carries forward to our families, or even if you've created amazing businesses or charities, that this is carried forward properly. So to make sure that the structures and the plans that you put in place has the right effect. If you have a child that we often find, a child that might be autistic or not capable of looking after themselves, that a special trust is put in place with the correct trustees and the correct structures to take off, to, you know, to look after this child, or a family member or parent that may need to be looked after. So unfortunately, how fiduciary specialist often says, your bus is going to come at some point, and you want to make sure that what you're leaving behind for your family is put in this in a structure that has follows your intentions and follows what you want to leave behind.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Nicola Langridge, a certified financial planner at Private Client Holdings. Thank you so much for the insight, particularly in this important August Women's Month. And such an interesting response to our online poll yesterday. I asked you about the legacy of the outgoing Chief Justice Raymond Zondo. We have a real split here. 37% of our respondents saying a legal giant, 33% saying solid, and 30% saying he could have done more. And our poll today, our lead story today, Qatar Airways acquiring a 25% stake in Airlink. And I'd like your view on this. Either I use Airlink, not my first choice of airline, or it's a clever strategic move. If you have a view on that, I invite you to go to either our X or LinkedIn page. And that is also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.